Chapter 29. The Loss of a Hill. "Focus attention on the fades," Egwene said, releasing a burst of air toward the Trollocs climbing up the hillside. The Trollocs had made a gaping hole in the ranks of pikemen defending the hill and were pouring through. Now accustomed to assaulting channelers, they squatted and braced themselves. That gave Egwene a good view of the Fist and the Murdral hiding at the very center. It wore a brown coat over its usual clothing and held a Trolloc catchpole. "No wonder I had trouble spotting him," Egwene thought, destroying the creature with a weave of fire. The half-man writhed, shaking and screeching in the fire, its eyeless face turned toward the heavens. The Fist of Trollocs dropped as well. Egwene smiled in satisfaction, but her pleasure was short-lived. Her archers were getting low on arrows, the pike ranks were tattered, and some of the Aes Sedai were clearly fatigued. Another wave of Trollocs replaced those that Egwene had dropped. "Will we be able to stand another day of this?" she thought. A banner of lancers suddenly broke from the left flank of Bryn's army fighting at the river. They flew the Flame of Tarvalin. That would be the unit of heavy cavalry that Bryn was proud of. He had cobbled them together under Captain Joni Chagrin out of a mix of seasoned veterans from the cavalries of other countries and those soldiers from the Tower Guard who wanted to join this elite fighting force. The lancers skirted the Sharans opposite them and rode furiously toward Egwene's hills, directly at the rear of the Trolloc army that was assaulting her position. Right behind them, a second cavalry unit followed in the dust of the first, this one displaying the dark green banner of Ilion. It looked like the general was finally going to send her some relief. But wait. Egwene frowned. From her vantage, she could see that the main army's left flank was completely unprotected now. What is he doing? Some sort of trap for the Sharans? If there had been a trap planned, the jaws did not snap shut. Instead, a Sharan cavalry unit charged into Bryn's exposed left flank and began to inflict heavy casualties on the foot soldiers defending that position at the river. And then Egwene saw another movement on the field below that really horrified her. An even larger Sharan cavalry banner had broken off the enemy's right flank and was bearing down on the lancer unit that had come to help Egwene. "Gawain! Get word to those lancers! It's a trap!" But there was no time to do anything. Within moments, the Sharan cavalry had begun slaying the White Tower lancers from behind. At the same time, the back ranks of Trollocs had turned around to face the lancer charge. Egwene could see that these Trollocs all carried long pole arms that ripped through the flesh of man and horse. The front ranks of lancers went down in a bloody heap, and the Trollocs waded between the bodies to pull down and thrust their weapons through the cavalrymen behind. Egwene shouted, drawing what power she could, and trying to destroy that Trolloc force, and the other women joined her. It was a massacre on both sides. There were just too many Trollocs, and the lancers were unprotected. In minutes it was over. Only a few cavalrymen had managed to survive, and Egwene saw them riding at full bore toward the river. It shook her. At times, the armies seemed to move at the turgid pace of enormous ships at dock, and then, in an instant, everything would burst and entire banners would have perished. She looked away from the corpses below. The Aes Sedai positions on the hilltops had been compromised. As the Trollocs returned their attention toward her force, Egwene gave orders for gateways. She had the pikemen withdraw uphill through the gateways as her archers continued to shoot projectiles into the Trollocs below. Then Egwene and the remaining Aes Sedai rained destruction down on the Trollocs long enough to get the archers through the gateways. Before disappearing through the last gateway on her hill, Egwene gave a final look at the battlefield. What had just happened? She shook her head as Gawain stepped up to her side, faithful as always. He hadn't had an opportunity to draw his sword this battle. Neither had Lyalwyn. The two seemed to be having a little silent competition as to who could act as the better guard, remaining right by Egwene's side. She'd have found it annoying, but it was better than Gawain's sullen regret in previous battle engagements. He was looking pale, though, as if at the start of a sickness. Had he been getting enough sleep? "I want to go to the camp and find General Bryn," Egwene said. "I want to know why this was allowed to happen. And then I will go to our troops defending the ford and avenge our people who just lost their lives here." They both gave her frowns.
"Egwene," Gawain said.
"I have strength yet," Egwene said. "I've been using the Sang Greal to keep from having to work too hard. The men fighting in that quarter need to see me, and I must do good where I can. I will take as many guards as you wish me to take." Gawain hesitated, glanced at Lyalwyn, then finally nodded.
Lan dismounted and handed the reins to Andir, then continued past the guards, who seemed shocked to see him and his numerous guards, many of them bloodied, toward the command tent. The tent was little more than an awning now, open on all sides, with soldiers moving in and out like ants in a hill. The air was hot here in Shinar today. He had not received reports recently from the other battlefronts, but had heard his would not be the only desperate stand today. Elaine fought at Kyrian, the Ammerlin on the border of Arafel. Lights said that they were having a better time of it than Lan. Inside the tent, Agilmar stood with maps on the ground all around him, pointing at them with a thin pole and moving bits of colored stone around as he gave orders. Runners would come and give updates on the progress of battle. The best battle plans lasted only until the first sword was drawn, but a good general could work battles like a potter working clay, taking the ebbs and flows of soldiers and molding them.
"Lord Mandragoran?" Agilmar asked, looking up. "Light man, you look like the blight itself. Have you seen the Aes Sedai for healing?"
"I am well," Lan said. "How goes the battle?"
"I'm encouraged," Agilmar said. "If we can find some way to stall those dreadlords for an hour or two, I think we actually have a fair shot of turning the Trollocs back."
"Surely not," Lan said. "There are so many."
"It's not about numbers," Agilmar said,
waving Lan over, pointing at a map.
"Lan, here is a thing that few men understand. Armies can and often do break when they have superior numbers, superior battlefield advantage, and a good chance of winning. When you spend time commanding, you start to think of an army as a single entity, a massive beast with thousands of limbs. That's a mistake. An army is made up of men, or in this case Trollocs, each one on the field, each one terrified. Being a soldier is about keeping your terror in check. The beast inside just wants to escape."
Lan crouched down, inspecting the battle maps. The situation was much as he'd seen it, only Agilmar still had the Saldaean light cavalry watching the eastern flank on the map. A mistake? Lan had confirmed for himself that they were no longer there. Shouldn't runners have brought Agilmar word that the map was wrong? Or was he somehow distracting them from noticing?
"I'll show you something today, Lan," Agilmar said softly. "I'll show you what the smallest man on the practice yard must learn if he is to survive. You can make the larger enemy break if you convince him that he is going to die. Hit him hard enough, and he will run, and won't return to let you hit again, even if you're secretly too weak to hit again."
"That's your plan, then?" Lan asked.
"Today?" "The Trollocs will break if we show them a display of force that frightens them," Agilmar said. "I know it can work. I'm hoping that we can bring down the leader of those dreadlords. If the Trollocs assume they're losing, they will run. They are cowardly beasts."
Listening to Agilmar made it seem plausible. Perhaps Lan just wasn't seeing the entire picture. Perhaps the great captain's genius was beyond what others could fathom. Had he done right in countermanding the order to move the archers? The messenger Lan had sent earlier came galloping back to the command center. One of Lan's high guard was there too, holding his own arm, a black-fletched arrow stuck in it.
"An enormous force of Shadowspawn," the messenger said. "Coming in from the east. Daishan, you were right."
They knew to come in that way, Lan thought. They couldn't have just noticed that we'd exposed ourselves, not with those hills blocking their view. It's come too quickly. The Shadow must have been told, or must have known what to expect.
He looked at Aglamar.
"Impossible,"
Aglamar said.
"What's this now? Why didn't the scouts see it?"
"Lord Aglamar,"
one of his commanders said,
"you sent the scouts in the east back to look at the river, remember? They were to inspect the crossing for us. You said the archers would..."
The commander paled.
"The archers?"
"The archers are still in their positions," Lan said, rising. "I want the front lines to begin withdrawing. Pull the Saldarians out of the fighting, ready to strike to help the foot soldiers disengage. Pull the Ashaman back. We'll need gateways."
"Lord Mandragoran," Aglamar said,
"this new development can be used. If we pull apart and then smash them between us, we can..."
"You are relieved of duty, Lord Aglamar,"
Lan said, not looking at the man.
"And unfortunately, I must request that you remain under supervision until I can sort through what has happened."
The command tent grew silent, every aide, messenger, and officer turning toward Lan.
"Now, Lan," Aglamar said, "that sounded like you are having me arrested."
"I am,"
Lan said, motioning to the high guard. They moved into the tent, taking positions to keep anyone from escaping. Some of Aglamar's men did reach for swords, but most looked confused and only rested their hands on the hilts.
"This is an outrage,"
Aglamar said.
"Don't be a fool. This isn't the time."
"What would you have me do, Aglamar?"
Lan barked.
"Let you run this army into the ground? Let the Shadow take us? Why are you doing this? Why?"
"You're overreacting, Lan,"
Aglamar said, keeping his calm with obvious difficulty, his eyes burning.
"What's going through your head? Light."
"Why did you pull the archers off of the eastern hills?"
"Because I needed them elsewhere."
"And does that make sense?"
Lan demanded.
"Didn't you tell me that guarding that flank was vital?"
You drew away the scouts from that position, too. Why?"
Aglamar raised a hand to his head, looking dazed. He looked down at the battle map, and his eyes widened.
"What's wrong with you, Aglamar?"
Lan said.
"I don't know,"
the man said. He blinked, staring at the maps at his feet. His face adopted a look of horror, eyes wide, lips parting.
"Oh, Light, what have I done?"
"Pass my orders,"
Lan said urgently to his high guard.
"Bring Lord Balderi to the command tent. Queen Atheniella and King Isar as well."
"Lan, you have to bring the..."
Aglamar stopped.
"Light, I can't say it. I start thinking about what to do, and the wrong thoughts come into my head. I'm still trying to sabotage us. I've doomed us."
His eyes wide, he reached for his short sword, sliding the blade free. Lan caught the sword around the guard and the blade collar, stopping it just before Aglamar could ram it into his stomach and end his life. Blood seeped between Lan's fingers from where one brushed the sharp edge of the blade, just below the collar.
"Let me die with honor,"
Aglamar said.
I've destroyed us all. I've lost us this war, Lan."
"Not the war, just the battle," Lan said. "Something is wrong with you. A sickness, a fatigue, or something of the Shadow. I suspect we'll find someone has been tampering with your mind."
"But..."
"You are a soldier,"
Lan bellowed.
"Act like one."
Aglamar froze. He met Lan's eyes, then nodded once. Lan removed his fingers from the blade, and Aglamar thrust it back in its sheath. The great captain sat down cross-legged in the traditional Shinaran meditation position, eyes closed. Lan strode away, calling orders. Prince Kaisel ran up to him, obviously afraid.
"What's happening, Lord Mandragoran?"
"Compulsion, likely," Lan said. "We've been like rabbits in a snare, with the line being drawn slowly but snugly around our necks.
Someone please tell me the Ashaman still have enough strength for gateways. And bring me news of the eastern flank. Those archers will need support. Commit the rest of the reserves to protecting them."
Prince Kaisel backed away as the orders continued, his eyes wide, his hand on his sword. He looked at Lord Aglomar, face pale.
"We've really lost?"
he asked Lan once the orders were out, messengers racing to deliver them.
"Yes," Lan said, "we have."
"Lan!"
Aglomar said suddenly, opening his eyes. Lan turned to him.
"Queen Zenobia,"
Aglomar said.
"I've sent her into danger without understanding what I'd done. Whoever put these plans into my head wanted her dead."
Lan swore softly, bolting out of camp and up the side of the nearest hill. The scouts there made room for him as he reached the top, pulling his looking glass from his belt. He didn't need it. He found the queen's flag while scanning the battlefield. She was surrounded. Whatever support she had thought she would receive had not been sent. Lan opened his mouth to call orders, but they died on his lips as the Trollocs swarmed over the small flag of white and silver where she'd been fighting. It fell, and in seconds he couldn't pick out a living soldier in that section of the battlefield. Coldness. He could do nothing for Zenobia. It was no longer about saving individuals. He would be lucky to escape this day with any semblance of an army at all. Matt rode with Tuon south toward the battlefield, along the banks of the river that was the western border of Arafel. Of course, where Tuon went, so did Seleucia. And now Min. Tuon wanted to keep her new Doomseer at her side at all times. Tuon kept asking for viewings, and Min kept reluctantly explaining what she saw. Matt had tried to make her say she saw a hat floating around Matt's head. That would persuade Tuon to stop trying to get rid of his, would it not? It would have been better than Min explaining about the eye on a scale and the dagger and all the other bloody things she had seen about Matt. Where Tuon went, 100 of the Death Watch guards also went. And Golgon, and Kurtani, who felt chastised for not acting quickly enough to help Matt. Furyk Kareed went along too, leading the Death Watch guard. Being around Kareed was about as pleasant as finding another man's hand in your purse. But he was a good soldier, and Matt respected him. He would very much like to put Kareed and Lan in a staring contest together. They could be at it for years. "I need a better view," Matt said, scanning the battlefield when they came within range. "There." He turned Pips and rode toward a rise close enough to where the opposing forces traded destruction at the river's edge. Tuon followed him without a word. When they all reached the rise, he noticed Seleucia staring daggers at him. "What's wrong?" Matt asked. "I'd have assumed you would be happy to have me back. It gives you someone else to scowl at."
"The Empress will follow where you go," she said.
"So she will," Matt said. "As I'll follow where she goes, I suppose. I hope that doesn't lead us in too many circles." He inspected the combat. The river was not terribly wide, maybe 50 spans across, but it was swift-moving and deep on either side of the ford. The water made a nice barrier, and not just for Trollocs. The ford, though, made for an easy crossing. The water there was knee-deep and wide enough for at least 20 files of riders to cross at the same time. In the distant middle of the Sharan army, a man sat upon a brilliant white horse. Matt could barely make him out with his glass. The man's glistening armor didn't seem like any Matt had seen, though the distance made it difficult to tell specifics.
"I assume that's our Forsaken?" he asked, gesturing with the Ashandarai.
"He seems to be yelling for the Dragon Reborn," Golgon said.
Demandred's voice boomed across the battlefield right then, enhanced by the One Power. He was demanding that the dragon come and face him in a duel. Matt inspected the fellow through the glass.
"Demandred, eh? Has he gone a bit dotty or what?
Well, Matt knew which part of the battle to bloody stay away from. He had not signed up to fight Forsaken. In fact, so far as he remembered, he had not signed up at all. He had been bloody press-ganged every step of the way. Usually by force and always by one fool woman or another. Egwene could deal with Demandred, or maybe the Ashaman could. Rand said the Ashaman were not going crazy anymore, but that was a shallow promise. Any man who wanted to wield the One Power was already crazy so far as Matt considered it. Adding more crazy to them would be like pouring tea into an already full cup. At least Tuon's Demani had those Sharan channelers occupied. Their firefight ripped up the ground on both riverbanks. It was impossible to get a clear picture of what was going on, though. There was just too much confusion. Matt pointed his looking glass southward along the river once more and frowned. There was a military camp set up just a few hundred paces opposite the ford, but it wasn't the haphazard arrangement of tents that caught his attention. At the eastern edge of the camp was a large body of troops and their horses, just standing there. He picked out a figure pacing in front of the assembly, who appeared to be in a foul mood. Matt might have been missing an eye, but it was no difficult task to recognize Ty Lee. Matt lowered the looking glass. He rubbed his chin, adjusted his hat, and set his Ashandarai on his shoulder. "Give me 5 minutes on my own," he said, then kicked Pips into a gallop down the hill, hoping that Tuon would let him go alone. For once, she did, though as he reached the base of the rise, he could imagine her up there watching him with those curious eyes of hers. She seemed to find everything he did to be interesting. Matt galloped alongside the river toward Ty Lee's location. Explosions rang out, painful to the ears, announcing that he had neared the heart of the battle. Matt nudged Pips to the left and rode directly toward the pacing general.
"Ty Lee, you light-blinded fool! Why are you sitting around here instead of making yourself useful?"
"Highness," Ty Lee said, falling to her knees. "We were ordered to stay here until we were called."
"Who told you to do that? And get up."
"General Bryn, Highness," she said, rising.
He could sense the annoyance in her tone, but she kept her face under control.
"He said that we were only a reserve force, and that under no circumstances were we to move from here until he gave his order. He said many lives depended on it. But look, you can see for yourself," she said, gesturing toward the river. "The battle is not going well."
Matt had been too caught up with Ty Lee to see the state of affairs across the water, but now he gave the field a wide sweep with his eye. While the Demani still seemed to be holding their own against the Sharan channelers, the regular troops were clearly in a bind. The defenses on Bryn's left flank downriver had completely broken down, and the soldiers there were being mobbed by Sharans. Where was the cavalry? It was supposed to be protecting the flanks. And, as Matt had predicted, Sharan archers had moved out into the field and were sending arrows into Bryn's cavalry on the right flank. It was all like a boil being squeezed, and Bryn's troops were the boil about to pop.
"This doesn't make any bloody sense," Matt said. "He's spinning this more and more into a disaster. Where is the general now, Ty Lee?"
"I cannot say, Highness. I have people out looking for him, but so far there is no word. But I have reports that our side has had a major setback just south of here. Two large cavalry units of General Bryn's have been wiped out by the Sharans just below the hills on the border. It is said they had been sent there to relieve the Marath Damani on the hilltops."
"Blood and bloody ashes," Matt considered this information.
"All right, Ty Lee. We can't wait around any longer. Here's what we're going to do. Have Banner General Makoti take the second banner right up the middle. He has to work his way around our troops fighting there and push back those Sharans. You take the third banner and swing around to the right flank. Take out those archers and any other goat-kissers that cross your path. I'm going to take the first banner over to the left flank and put a patch on those defenses. Get going, Ty Lee."
"Yes, Highness. But surely you aren't going to get so close to the battle."
"Yes, I am. Now get going, Ty Lee."
"Please, if I might make a humble suggestion, Highness. You are unprotected. Let me at least give you some proper armor.
Matt thought for a moment, then agreed that her suggestion was a prudent one. A person could get hurt out here, what with arrows flying and blades swinging. Tylee called over one of her senior officers, who seemed to be about the same size as Matt. She had the man remove his armor, which was extremely colorful, overlapping plates lacquered green, gold, and red, outlined with silver. The officer looked bemused when Matt handed him his coat in trade, saying that he expected it to be returned at the end of the day in the same condition. Matt put on the armor, which covered his chest, the back of his arms, and the front of his thighs, and it felt comfortable enough. When the officer held out his helmet, though, Matt ignored him, merely adjusting his wide-brimmed hat as he turned to Tylee.
Highness, one more thing. The Marath Damani.
I'll deal with those channelers personally, Matt said. She gawked at him as if he were insane. Bloody ashes, he probably was.
Highness, Tylee said. The Empress.
She stopped when she saw Matt's expression.
Let us at least send for some Damani to protect you.
I can take care of myself just fine, thank you very much. Those bloody women would just get in my way. He grinned. Are you ready, Tylee? I would really like this over with before it's time for my bedtime mug of ale. In response, Tylee turned and yelled,
Mount up!
Light, she had a strong set of lungs. With that, thousands of bottoms hit their saddles, producing a slapping sound that reverberated across the legion, and each soldier sat at attention, eyes straight ahead. He'd give the Seanchan one thing. They trained bloody good soldiers. Tylee barked out a series of orders, turned back to Matt, and said,
On your command, Highness.
Matt cried out,
Los Cabadrin!
Words most of those assembled did not understand, and yet instinctively knew to mean horsemen forward. As Matt spurred Pips into the waters of the ford, the Ashandarai raised above his head, he heard the ground rumble as the first banner closed ranks around him. The blaring Seanchan horns behind were giving the call to charge, each horn pitched slightly differently from the next, producing a grating dissonant sound meant to be heard at great distances. Ahead, soldiers of the White Tower glanced over their shoulders at the noise, and in the seconds it took Matt and the Seanchan to cross the passage, soldiers were flinging themselves out of the way to make room for the riders. Just a short veer to the left, and the Seanchan were suddenly in the thick of Sharan cavalry, which had been grinding through Egwene's foot soldiers. The speed of their approach enabled the Seanchan vanguard to smash hard into the Sharans, their well-trained steeds rearing up just before crashing down on the foe with their forelegs. Sharans and their mounts fell, many crushed as the Seanchan cavalry continued their relentless forward motion. The Sharans appeared to know what they were about, but these were heavy cavalry, weighted down with burdensome armor and equipped with long lances, perfect for eliminating foot soldiers with their backs up against a wall, but disadvantaged against a highly mobile light cavalry in such tight quarters. The first banner were a crack unit that used a wide variety of weaponry, and they were trained to work in teams. Spears thrown by lead riders with deadly accuracy plunged into the visors of the Sharans, a surprising number of which went through the slits and into faces. Pushing through behind were riders wielding two-handed swords with curved blades, slicing their weapons across vulnerable space that separated helmets from the top of body armor, or at other times slashing the vulnerable chests of armor-clad Sharan mounts, bringing their riders to the ground. Other Seanchan used hooked pole arms to pull Sharans out of the saddle while their partners swung spiked maces at the enemy, denting their armor so much that movement was severely restricted. And when the Sharans were on the ground, trying with difficulty to rise, the spikers would descend on them. Lightly armed Seanchan, whose job it was to pull up visors of the fallen and thrust a narrow dagger into exposed eyes. The lances of the Sharans were useless under these conditions. In fact, they were a hindrance, and many Sharans died before they could drop their lances and draw swords. Matt ordered one of his cavalry squadrons to ride along the water's edge until they reached the far left edge of battle, and then to swing around the Sharan cavalry. No longer overwhelmed by Sharan lances, the White Tower infantry on the left center were able to use their pikes and halberds again, and with the addition of the efforts of the Seanchan second and third banners, defenses were slowly re-established at the ford. It was dirty, slippery work, as the ground within several hundred paces of the river got beaten down and became an expanse of churned-up mud, but the forces of light stood their ground. Matt found himself washed into the thick of the fray, and his Ashendari never stopped spinning. He quickly found, however, that his weapon was not very useful. A few of his swings met with vulnerable flesh, but most of the time his blade glanced off the armor of his opponents, and he was forced to duck and twist in the saddle repeatedly to avoid being struck by a Sharan blade. Matt slowly worked his way forward through the brawl and had nearly reached the back lines of Sharan cavalry when he realized that three of his companions were no longer in their saddles. Odd, they had just been there a minute ago. Two others stiffened up, scanning from side to side, and suddenly they both went up in flames, screaming in agony and throwing themselves to the ground before going limp. Matt looked to his right just in time to see a Shanchan flung back 100 feet in the air by an unseen force. When he turned back, his eye met the gaze of a most beautiful woman. She was oddly clad in a black silk dress that stood out from her body, adorned with white ribbons. She was a dark-skinned beauty, like Tuon, but there was nothing delicate about her bold, high cheekbones and wide, sensuous mouth, lips that seemed to pout, until they curved up into a smile that was not meant to comfort him. As she stared at him, his medallion grew cold. Matt breathed out. Luck seemed to be with him so far, but he did not want to press it too far, any more than you wanted to press your best racehorse. He would still have a healthy need of that luck in the days to come. Matt dismounted and walked toward her as the woman gasped, trying another weave, her eyes wide with amazement. Matt flipped the Ashendari around and spun it, sweeping her feet from beneath her. He brought the haft just below the blade back down to his right, cracking her on the back of the head as she fell. She landed face down in the mud. Matt did not have time to pull her out as he was suddenly confronted by dozens of Sharans. 10 of Matt's soldiers filled out around him, and he pressed forward. These Sharans only had swords. Matt fended them off with spinning blade and pole, and he and the Shanchan fought furiously. The fight became a blur of sweeping weapons, his Ashendari spraying clods of mud into the air. 2 of Matt's men grabbed the face-down woman before she could suffocate in the mire. Matt pushed forward. Men yelled, calling for reinforcements. Steps taken cautiously, but inevitably forward. The ground was turning red. Sharan soldiers replaced the ones who were slain, and the bodies of the fallen sank deeper in the mud. Soldiers often were a grim folk, but each of these Sharans seemed personally intent on killing him, until the Sharans stopped coming. Matt looked around him. There were only 4 Shanchan remaining at his side. Despite the chaos of the fight, Matt felt he saw more clearly than he had before, and the lull in the fighting gave him a chance to act like a commander again. "Bind that woman's hands behind her back," Matt said, panting, to the men around him, "and tie a cloth around her eyes so that she can't see anything." He wiped the sweat from his brow. Light, there was enough of it for a second river. "We are going to push our way back to the ford with our prisoner. I'll see if I can find a few more of those bloody Damani to throw into this battle. The Sharans were wrong to leave only one of their channelers by herself on the battlefield, but let's get out of here before any more of them show up." Matt shook his hand. He had cracked one of his nails, splitting the fine lacquer. He turned to a Shanchan officer, one of those who had fought alongside him. The man wore an expression of awe, as if he were staring at the dragon bloody reborn himself. Matt looked down at the ground, not liking the man's expression, but he supposed it wasn't any worse than looking at the blood-soaked muck littered with Sharan corpses. How many had Matt killed?
"Highness," the officer said, "great lord, no man in the Empire's service would ever dare question the Empress, may she live forever. But if a man had wondered about some of her choices, she would do so no longer. Prince of the Ravens!"
He raised his sword, prompting a cheer from those behind. "Get yourself some bloody pole arms," Matt said. "Those swords are next to useless for foot soldiers in this battle." He chewed a bit off the offending fingernail, then spat it to the side. "You fellows did well. Anyone see my horse?" Pips was nearby, and so, taking his mount's reins, he headed back toward the ford. He even managed to stay out of more skirmishes, for the most part. That Shonshan captain reminded him a little too much of Talmanis, and Matt had enough people following him about. I wonder if he plays dice, Matt thought idly, stepping into the water. His boots were good, but all boots eventually leaked, and his feet squished inside his stockings as he walked across the ford with Pips. There was a commotion far to his right on the bank, what appeared to be a gathering of Aes Sedai channeling toward the battlefield. But Matt had no intention of sticking his nose into their business. He had larger issues on his mind. Ahead, Matt saw a man standing by a tree, dressed in voluminous pants and a familiar-looking coat. He approached the man, and after a brief conversation, exchanged garb with him. Feeling good about being back in his Two Rivers coat, Matt heaved himself into the saddle, legs still dripping water, and rode back toward where he had left Tuon. His men had brought that Sharan channeler. By his order, they'd gagged her and blindfolded her. Light, what would he do with her? She'd probably end up as a Damani. He left his soldiers and passed the guards, now set up at the base of the little rise, with barely a nod. The battlefield spread out in his mind, no longer little drawings on paper. He could see the field, hear the men fighting, smell the rancid breath of the enemy. It was real to him now. "The Empress," Seleucia said as he reached the top of the rise, "would like to know, with great specificity, exactly why you saw fit to put yourself into the skirmish in such an irresponsible way. Your life is no longer your own, Prince of the Ravens. You cannot toss it aside as you once might have." "I had to know," Matt said, looking out. "I had to feel the pulse of the battle." "The pulse," Seleucia said. Tuon was talking through her by wiggling her fingers like some bloody maiden of the spear, not speaking to him directly. Bad sign. "Every battle has a pulse, Tuon," Matt said, still staring into the middle distance. "Nynaeve, she would sometimes feel a person's hand to check their heartbeat, and from there would know that something was wrong with their feet. It's the same thing. Step into the struggle, feel its motion. Know it." A servant with his head half-shaven stepped up to Tuon, whispering to her and Seleucia. He had come from the ford. Matt kept looking out, remembering maps, but overlaying them with the real combat. Bryn failing to use Ty Lee in combat, exposing his defense's left flank at the ford, sending his cavalry into a trap. The battle opened to him, and he saw tactics 10 steps ahead of what was occurring. It was like reading the future, like what Min saw, only with flesh, blood, swords, and battle drums. Matt grunted.
"Huh.
Garth Bryn is a dark friend."
"He what?"
Min sputtered. "This battle is one step away from being doomed," Matt said, turning to Tuon. "I need absolute control of our armies right now. No more arguing with Gul'gan. Min, I need you to send to Egwene and warn her that Bryn is trying to lose this battle. Tuon, she'll need to go in person. I doubt Egwene will listen to anyone else." Everyone looked at Matt with stunned expressions. Everyone but Tuon, who gave him one of those soul-shaking stares of hers. The ones that had him feeling as if he were a mouse who had just been caught in an otherwise immaculately clean room. That made him sweat more than the battle had. "Come on," he thought. "There isn't time." He could see it now, like a grand game of stones. Bryn's movements were complex and subtle, but the end result would be the destruction of Egwene's army. Matt could stop it, but he had to act now.
"It is done," Tuon said.
The comment provoked almost as much surprise as Matt's announcement. Captain General Gul'gan looked as if he would rather swallow his own boots than have Matt in command. Min found herself being led away by a group of servants and soldiers, and she gave a squawk of annoyance. Tuon moved her horse nearer to Matt's.
"I am told," she said softly, "that in the battle moments ago, you not only claimed Amarath Damani for yourself, but also raised one of our officers to the low blood."
"I did?" Matt asked, baffled. I don't remember that.
You dropped your nail at his feet.
Oh, that... All right, maybe I did that. Accidentally. And the channeler? Bloody ashes to on. I didn't mean for her to... I guess. Well, you can have her.
No, Tuan said. It is well for you to have taken one of your own. You cannot train her, of course, but there are many Suldam who will be eager for the chance. It is very rare that a man captures a Damani personally on the battlefield. Very rare indeed. Though I know of your particular advantage, others do not. This will greatly increase your reputation.
Matt shrugged. What else could he do? Maybe if the Damani belonged to him, he could let her free or something.
I will have the officer you raised transferred to be your personal retainer, Tuan said. He has a good record, perhaps too good. He had been assigned that duty at the Ford because he was considered potentially part of a faction who would have moved against us. He is now spouting your praises. I do not know what you did to change his opinion. You seem to have a particular skill at that.
Let's just hope I have as much skill for retrieving a victory, Matt grumbled. This is bad, Tuan.
Nobody else thinks so.
She said the words carefully, not arguing with him really, stating a fact. I'm right anyway. I wish I wasn't, but I am. I bloody am.
If you are not, I will lose influence.
You'll be fine, Matt said, leading the way back toward the Seanchan camp a few miles north at a brisk pace. I may lead you wrong now and then, but in the end, you can be sure that I'm always a safe bet.